All right, so we're sort of moving to a slightly different scale again now. Well, I don't know exactly how much we are, but anyway.
We'll see.
Different perspective, that's right. And John Hibbard from the ACT Conservation Council is going to talk for a perspective at that scale. So thanks, John.
Thanks very much. This isn't one of my normal, very professional presentations because of time constraints, so I haven't even had a slide at the beginning saying who I am. And I will apologise that I'm probably going to tread on some eggshells and disturb some sacred cows. And I am slightly concerned that I see many of my friends and colleagues from the ACT administration in the audience here. So please don't take any of the comments I'm making too personally. This presentation doesn't just encompass the ACT, it encompasses the bioregion, because obviously biodiversity and climate change don't recognise jurisdictional boundaries. So I just wanted to start off with some of the gems that came out of Ghana at the Ecological Society conference this week on the opening day about how climate change is going to be one of the single greatest driver of biodiversity loss. The biodiversity sector is the one that's going to be most impacted by climate change, and that Australia has the most to gain from global climate change mitigation. But then some really interesting issues that he raised, one of which indicating that as incomes rise, people value biodiversity and the natural estate even higher. So how do we end up valuing the future in respect of what we are spending now? And this is a really difficult question for policymakers, particularly those that have to allocate funds to climate change mitigation and adaption. And he made the point very clearly that on the modelling that's been done, that the cost of climate change mitigation and adaption undertaken right now will in fact lead to increased benefits later. But that's a timescale that politicians don't always operate on. And I think it's really important, we've heard a lot of talks this week at the Ecological Society conference about some really great science that's been going on and providing many of the answers that we need to resolve some of those uncertainties that people have spoken about. But science doesn't operate in a vacuum, and unfortunately promotion for scientists isn't based on doing good in society. It's based on the papers you publish. And this was alluded to in a couple of the talks. Scientists operate in society, and society operates in the political system. And there's some real constraints in our political system to actually tackling some of these climate change mitigation problems. I'm not going to spend very long on this because Bob Webb covered all these. So this is just a list of the kinds of impacts on natural ecosystems that climate change is going to have. You've probably seen them a number of times in previous presentations. So I'll move on. This is a policy briefing for the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, which is a unique global organisation comprising both government agencies, national governments, state government agencies, and also the wider non-government community across the globe. And they've identified this dichotomy that we've got between well-managed ecosystems and their role that they can play in adapting to climate change and their ease in recovering from extreme weather events, to the contrast of poorly managed, fragmented and degraded ecosystems. So let's look at some of the issues from the perspective of a community-based organisation in dealing with climate change adaption for biodiversity. There appears to be an unwillingness in the political sphere to grasp the scope of climate change impacts on biodiversity and on ecosystem functioning, particularly on ecosystem functioning. There's some grasping of the impact that they'll have on individual species, particularly the cuddly ones. Big problem is that political systems operate at different timescales to climate change and to biodiversity adaptation. There is clear evidence that the political system undervalues biodiversity and undervalues the importance of ecosystem services. And there is throughout, I believe, in Australia, an excessive faith in static protected areas to conserve our biota for all time. There's also evidence that we're getting diminishing resources for on-ground management, particularly the increasing threats that we're seeing from invasive species and the increased impact of recreation in our natural areas as our population grows, as people become more interested in their natural environment and want to go out there and experience it. I also believe there's a lack of a policy framework across government for landscape scale adaption measures, for restoration programs, for connectivity protection. And unfortunately, because of our political system, there is a fragmented policy development and natural resource management. Because of the silos, the political system that we have allocates responsibilities to ministers who have boundaries around their responsibilities. And time after time, when we go and talk to ministers, whether it's at a state level or at a federal level, we're told that this issue is not in my portfolio, you must go and talk to another minister. It is almost impossible, certainly from the community organisation perspective, to get a whole of government response on issues like climate change adaption and biodiversity. There, of course, is the entrenchment of the economic growth paradigm, and we see that very strongly here in the ACT. And really, only lip service is still being paid to full triple bottom line accounting. So some of the challenges for policymakers, I believe, are the need to scale up investment in protection, management and restoration of catchments, landscapes and ecosystems. And there have been a number of really key papers at the Ecological Society conference that talk about the need that's going to arise for direct intervention. I'll talk a bit more about that later. The use of strategic assessments and planning tools to promote the protection of biodiversity and ecosystem services. And I am pleased to see, you know, Alan Hawke's recommendations on the EPBC review. And certainly I know that the previous Minister for Environment, Peter Garrett, was very keen to upgrade the role of strategic assessments on a national basis. I think we need to improve the integration of policy and planning and the on-ground programs and investment decisions across government, not just in those departments that are charged with natural resource management. And we need to design and implement robust monitoring and adaptive management processes. But most importantly, I think we need to plan for change. And there have been numerous speakers at the conference about this. We need to manage risk more conservatively, and we actually need to start applying that precautionary principle that gets trotted out as a catch-all phrase all the time. Everybody understands what it means. Everybody uses the word, but they don't actually apply it. So on a generic basis, I think some of the things that we can be doing about implementing ecosystem-based adaption is about fostering research and dialogue, and I'll talk a bit more about that in my final slide, on the valuation of ecosystem services and the role of natural ecosystems, biodiversity and ecosystem services, and this is the critical bit, in underpinning economic development. Because that's the driver. I mean, it was up there at the front in John's slide about economic viability of the country. It's what drives most governments in most of their decision making. And I think that many of them don't understand how natural ecosystems and ecosystem services underpin that economic development. We obviously need to protect our terrestrial, freshwater and marine ecosystems and those ecological corridors to conserve biodiversity and ecosystem services. And when we're looking at the potential of areas to become refugia as species and systems migrate across the landscape under climate change, we need to be able to provide them with opportunities to reach those areas. And the fragmentation that we've seen in our landscape, particularly in Eastern Australia, which is where I'm familiar, is making that challenge extremely difficult. And we need to integrate protection of natural habitats into those strategies to reduce vulnerability and disaster risks. So, what might we be able to do immediately? And this is going to be the slightly provocative bit. Hopefully it will generate some discussion. I realised when I wrote the first one, when I said create a central climate change policy unit, that of course here in the ACT we do have one, and we have one at a federal level. But the key words here is the word power. The power to coordinate whole of government adaption actions. I mean, weathering the change Mark II in the ACT is going to be a very important document, but my question to the ACT administration is, how are they going to embed that across all the agencies in the ACT, particularly those that are charged with economic development? The debate that we've had in Canberra here on developing a more compact city and therefore less of a spread to our city and the impact that that's having upon rural landscapes is another opportunity for the ACT to start looking at whole of government approaches to adaptation. Secondly, we can improve mitigation on a continent-wide scale through biosequestration by halting the ongoing land clearing that's still going on. All the indicators show that land clearing has really not abated much in recent decades. And of course, the contribution that the cessation of native forest logging can make to a reduction in our greenhouse gas emissions is well known and well understood. We need to integrate land management on a landscape scale across the region, across jurisdictions, and that's also going to be a real challenge for decision makers. We need to improve ecosystem resilience by resourcing connectivity across the landscape, with the key word being resourcing. Everybody talks about landscape connectivity, but actually achieving it is a very difficult challenge, and it's not going to be able to do, you're not going to be able to achieve it without resourcing it and without bringing the community on board with you. I think we really need to have full and transparent triple bottom line accounting to ensure that the intangible benefits that the community does value are fully integrated into our economic and social decision making. And I was a little bit disappointed in John's slide at the beginning that when he talked about the Commons responsibilities, he talked about economic development, he talked about the social safety net, but he did not talk about a healthy environment, which I would have thought was the third part of that triple bottom line. Richard Hobbs raised a very good point in his paper at the Ecological Society about how we need to start identifying what we really want to keep and ensure its survival. We're not going to be able to keep everything. All the indicators that the scientists have been providing to us show that we are going to lose species, we are going to lose robustness in some of our ecosystems. We need some mechanisms, we need some indicators too, and some processes to try and help us and help the decision makers identify what is it that we really need to keep in order to make sure that our ecosystems continue to function. And then you get into that really difficult debate about, is it better to let a species that's already highly endangered, is it better to let that species become extinct, but put some effort into making sure that all those species that are in the common area now, as a result of climate change, do not suddenly become vulnerable and endangered. And some of the examples from the wet tropics, I think, were really salutary about that. And that's a difficult thing because everybody has their pet species and nobody wants to see, ethically, any species become extinct. But it's a debate we have to have and it's a debate we have to resolve. I think also, and David Hilbert made this point, is that we need to change our horizons. We're very used to thinking in a very static equilibrium and preservation space. And we need to move towards anticipatory conservation. The protected area system that we have now is not going to be capable, if it ever was, of fully maintaining all our species and all our ecosystems. And obviously the ability of those protected areas to fully represent our biota across the continent is going to be severely challenged by climate change. So we need to start thinking about not just increasing or changing the number of our protected areas, but this is where landscape scale approaches to biodiversity conservation will be absolutely critical. Because I don't see in Australia that there's a real opportunity to suddenly start grabbing large chunks of country and saying this might become an important refuge for species in 50, 100 years' time, therefore we're going to create it as a national park now. The resistance to that and the cost of that would be too great. So we've got to develop those other tools. And I thought what Lorraine van Kerkhove was talking about last night in the public lecture about biodiversity and you about the importance of the work that's going on, for example, here in ANU in social science policy, in bridging that nexus between the work that the scientists are doing and what the community and the politicians and the decision makers understand is critically important to start making decisions about now, is really important. We need to start working with those social scientists so we get that message across, primarily, I think, to the community, because it's well known that most politicians are not actually leaders. They follow public opinion. So we have to make sure that we have the public along with us on this ride, this really tricky, rocky ride we're going to have towards climate change adaptation, if we're going to be able to maintain any semblance of the biota and the systems and the functioning of those ecosystems that we have now. So hopefully I've given you a few bits of food for thought.